All right. Excuse me. So last week we talked about dry bones, and we connected this to the final ordinary, extraordinary resurrection appearance, because no resurrection appearance is ordinary. And this is just before Pentecost, when the disciples are sitting down with Jesus, just before the giving of the Spirit. And the disciples ask this question of Jesus about the restoration of the kingdom to Israel. And we talked last week about how their question is too small, too narrow. Implications of resurrection isn't yet clear to them. They haven't totally grasped that yet, even as they sit in the presence of the resurrected Jesus. Resurrection, connecting this to Ezekiel 37, isn't just about dry bones coming to life. It's about the cleansing of the land. And even though Ezekiel has this image, this hope, this longing for the future, his vision is perhaps even a little too small, because it's not just for the dry bones of Israel, not just for the land of Israel. This stretches to all people. It stretches to the entire cosmos. Because resurrection extends beyond these categories, on these places. It transcends these categories and the expectations of the people. It transcends, indeed, their hopes. And the call to Jesus, the call from Jesus to his disciples is to partner with him through the Spirit to be restorers of this kingdom, to be restorers of the world, of creation, even to garden this new creation that has broken forth as he exits the tomb. So we've been journeying with Ezekiel in Lent and dealing with some of his messages of judgment, so that we can fully appreciate in this Easter time those messages of hope, those messages of future, of resurrection, of new creation, of new world. Ezekiel's messages don't end in despair. They end by looking forward into God's new creation, what he is going to do. So I'd like to back it up a little bit as far as resurrection appearances. Go and go all the way to John 21-18, which is on page 1646 in the Bible. This is going back to the beginning of resurrection appearances, or you might be even able to say back to the beginning of the future. All right. The new future that resurrection brings forth into the present, as Jesus appears to Mary in the garden and as she mistakes him for the gardener on that first Easter Sunday. I'm going to read that entire section from the visit to the tomb where she doesn't see Jesus, and all the way up until Mary hears Jesus' voice and recognizes him, so that we can fully get into that story. So, early on Sunday morning, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and found that the stone had been rolled away from the entrance. She ran and found Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. She said, "They have taken the Lord's body out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." Peter and the other disciple started out for the tomb. They were both running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He stooped and looked in and saw the linen wrapping lying there, but he didn't go in. Then Simon Peter arrived and went inside. He also noticed the linen wrapping lying there, while the cloth that had covered Jesus' head was folded up and lying apart from the other wrappings. Then the disciple who had reached the tomb first also went in, and he saw and believed. For until then, they still hadn't understood the scriptures that said Jesus must rise from the dead. Then they went home. Mary was standing outside the tomb crying, and as she wept, she stooped and looked in. She saw two white-robed angels, one sitting at the head and the other at the foot of the place where the body of Jesus had been lying. "Dear woman, why are you crying?" the angel asked her. "Because they have taken away my Lord," she replied, "and I don't know where they have put him." She turned to leave and saw someone standing there. It was Jesus, but she didn't recognize him. "Dear woman, why are you crying?" Jesus asked. "Who are you looking for?" She thought he was the gardener. "Sir," she said, "if you have taken him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will go get him." "Mary," Jesus said. She turned to him and cried out, "Rabboni," which is Hebrew for teacher. "Don't cling to me," Jesus said, "for I haven't yet ascended to the Father. But go find my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to the Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene found the disciples and told them, "I have seen the Lord." Then she gave them his message. So I probably mentioned this before. I'm actually sure I've mentioned it before, but I couldn't remember exactly when I did this. Anyway, one of my favorite lectures or sermons, and he actually calls it a lecture in his recording. This is where I disagree with him, because it's pure sermon, at least in how we use the words in English. And it's a sermon from many years ago called Jesus the World's True Light by N.T. Wright. And even though it's not specifically a resurrection sermon, it is indeed full of the implications of resurrection. And I've been greatly influenced by N.T. Wright in his writings about Christian discipleship, about historical methodology and historiography, about Jesus and resurrection. And all these things are part of this lecture and a culmination of his wrestling out with who Jesus is. And it had been a while since I'd listened to the lecture in its entirety, so I thought, well, this week is a good week to listen to it, to go through it. And I realized just how much he has influenced my thought around topics of new creation. It was always like a message that empowered me into the implications of service, of loving, of ministry. And I didn't realize how much resurrection infused all of that until this week, how the two are inseparably connected to one another. And so this is a long preamble to say that I wanted to use a quote that had stuck in my mind from this lecture for a long time, but I'm going to include even one more as the after effects of listening to this message. And the first thing, which I wasn't actually going to highlight, but it stuck out a little bit more to me as I was thinking through this message, and it's that John makes lots of efforts to highlight that new creation has happened in the resurrection of Jesus. And he sets this out in the sixth day, and then to the seventh day, and even the eighth day as Jesus rises from the dead kind of pattern. On the Friday, Pilate says, "Look, here is the man," verse 19, or chapter 19, verse 5. And it's the final act of creation, it's the sixth day, this activity of creating the first Adam. And as Jesus is presented in the trial, he's presented as the true human. Behold, the true human. Saturday, the day of rest, as God rested in his act of creation, Jesus rests in the tomb. And then the Sunday, the new day, the first day of new creation, the first day of the new week, of the new world. And I want to ask the question about coming out of this, and that is, where does this first act of new creation take place? In the Gospel of John, it's very clear that this is happening in a garden. John does a lot of things that are different than the other Gospels, than the Synoptics and Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John does things just slightly different and highlights specific elements in the story that are not drawn out the same way in the other Gospels. And one of these things is the importance of the garden, of a garden. Three important events happen in a garden. The first is the arrest of Jesus. In the Synoptic Gospel, Jesus goes and prays after the Last Supper with his disciples. In Matthew and Mark, he goes to Gethsemane. And in Luke, he goes to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus prays in this specific location. In John, Jesus finishes praying, and then he crosses the Kidron Valley to another place where there is a garden. This is specifically highlighted in the Gospel of John. And this is where he is met by Judas, the soldiers, the Pharisees, and the chief priests to arrest Jesus. In this garden, to be bound, captured, led away, not unlike the exiles that we talked about in Ezekiel and Lent, and more significantly, removed from the garden, not unlike humanity was removed from the garden in Genesis 3, both stories dealing with the effects of sin, although quite differently. The second occurrence is the burial of Jesus taking place in a garden. This is, again, a specific detail that John gives us in his Gospels, where the other Gospel writers don't highlight this. Most of the other details are quite similar. The involvement of Joseph of Arimathea, a tomb that somebody hasn't lied in before. But the fact that this tomb is in a garden is specifically highlighted in John. This becomes very important as we look at the implications in the next section. And this is the third event. That because the tomb where Jesus was laid is in a garden, the resurrection encounter that Jesus has with Mary is therefore also in a garden. And this gives explanation to why Mary was confused about Jesus being the gardener. And this brings us to the sentence that stuck in my head and has been stuck in my head for quite a while, that Wright uses in his lecture, and this is me quoting Wright. Mary goes to the tomb while it is still dark, and in the morning light she meets Jesus, yes, in the garden, and she thinks he is the gardener, as in one important sense, indeed he is. This is the new creation. This is the new Genesis, end quote. And it stuck in my head, that as in one important sense, he is the gardener of new creation, this first Easter day of new creation. Because Jesus is the gardener of new creation, the one who breathes life into the dead and decayed bones to give us life, to breathe life into the world for all the death and decay. As the Spirit was present in creation, so also the Spirit through Jesus, through the sending of the Spirit afterwards, is present in new creation, making it all new. His kingdom is new creation, his presence filling the entire earth, healing, restoring the land. I want to pause there for a moment in our discussion about Jesus as the gardener and talk about Ezekiel and garden imagery. And so if you turn over to Ezekiel 36, we're going to read verses 33 to 38. This passage immediately precedes the dry bones passage that we looked at last week. And this is a continuing of a lot of the hope imagery and excitement that Ezekiel has for when God will restore all things, when he will act to redeem his people. So verse 33, this is what the sovereign Lord says. When I cleanse you from your sins, I will repopulate your cities, and the ruins will be rebuilt. The fields that used to lie empty and desolate in plain view of everyone will again be farmed, and I will bring you back. Oh, and when I bring you back, people will say, this former wasteland is now like the Garden of Eden. The abandoned and ruined cities now have strong walls and are filled with people. Then the surrounding nations that survive will know that I, the Lord, have rebuilt the ruins and replanted the wasteland. For I, the Lord, have spoken, and I will do what I say. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I am ready to hear Israel's prayers and to increase their numbers like a flock. They will be as numerous as the sacred flocks that fill Jerusalem's streets at the time of her festivals. The ruined cities will be crowded with people once more, and everyone will know that I am the Lord. This message of hope is directed at the people in the wake of destruction, in the context of desolation. And last week I talked about dry bones and how for Ezekiel this would be more than just a metaphor. The effects of exile would have meant that lots of people would have died. So quite literally there would have been dead bones in Ezekiel's, or in the people of Jerusalem's view close to them. So this is more than just a metaphor for what they've experienced. At the same way, the idea of desolation, of fields being completely destroyed and trampled on, of houses being torn down and ruined, would be more than just a metaphor for Ezekiel. It's also, though, more than just a metaphor for the image of garden and for restoration and newness of life. The people would have viewed when God saved them, when he restored them, when he brought them back, that he would have indeed brought vegetation back to these desolate places, to take care of them, to restore them, to heal them, to nourish them as people. It's more than just a metaphor. And it connects to the Garden of Eden. This is the image of the fruitfulness of first creation, of the plenty of God's first act and God acting in creation in a way to sustain and care for the needs of his people. And in this act of creation, humanity is given the task to be image bearers in the garden, to be God's representatives in the world. And this is the task that persists for us even today. When I'm sketching out a sermon, I have various thought titles to help guide me when I'm doing sermon prep, and they're all titled something different, and normally they're things that I find humorous, like a Back to the Future joke. And this one I titled, From Garden to Garden, or Humanity's Role Doesn't Change. And this is what I think John is highlighting as Jesus meets Mary in the garden, as John sets up his gospel to highlight that this is the first act of new creation, is that humanity's role doesn't change. One of the things that often can be lost in the context of resurrection, and I'm always speaking from my experience within the church and growing up, is that in the celebration of the defeat of death, sometimes we focus so much on the fact that we have some sort of life, after death, to borrow another N.T. Wright line. And sometimes it overlooks the fact that the goal of humanity hasn't changed even in the resurrection. It remains the same, just even more so. Even more so because the consequence of resurrection is that death has been defeated and new creation continues on forward. Death has been defeated. Our role is still to be the image bearers of God in the garden. The defeat of death means existence. The world will continue. And this is a wonderful truth for us, but it's also a wonderful truth for creation and for the world. The directions that were given to humanity in the garden remain the same. We're still called to worship. We're still called to live in relationship. And we're still called towards stewardship of creation. In Genesis 2:15, it's highlighted that man was placed in the Garden of Eden, and I say man because woman hadn't been created yet in Genesis 2, to work it and to protect it, to guard it, to care for it, to look after it, to cultivate it, all ways to translate that word. Our role is to work in the midst of this new garden and new creation, to work it, to guard it, to cultivate it, to take care of it, to recognize that new creation is unfolding in our midst, in the garden that Jesus has given us. That Jesus' gardener has already started this process in his resurrection as he exits the tomb. The role of humanity hasn't changed. But now we have a signpost. We have somebody who truly reflects what it is to be the image of God, to truly live in these categories, to truly live in worship, to truly live in relationship, to truly be a steward of God's creation, the one who's fully able to reflect the image of God, Jesus the gardener. There is something very important that has changed, though, as Jesus exits the tomb. And this is connected to the Garden of Eden, in the sense that the Garden of Eden is no longer just limited to one place, to one boundary marker. Those fences, those boundaries have been taken away, and the Garden of Eden extends out from that tomb into all creation, into the entire world. As if the flaming sword and cherubim that are placed at the east side of the garden as humanity is ushered out of the garden have been removed as Jesus exits that tomb. As he exits, the garden is then moved outward, moved forward, moved into all reaches of creation, to the very ends of the earth, as the true gardener of this world. It's as if through the Spirit, the source of life, the tree of life that was at the center of the garden, can once again have its fruit plucked and tasted so that humanity may live forever, may sustain, because death has been defeated. But in all this, our task remains the same. Our role as God gave humanity in the garden is given to us as gardeners of new creation. And in resurrection, our task is somehow accented with the promise that in some transcendent way, some way beyond our understanding, our labors, our actions, our work extends through the resurrection with some permanence, with some fruitfulness beyond even ways that we can understand through the Spirit, through the fact that death has been defeated. In all these categories, we're called into true worship, to live in a praise that recognizes the fact that we will continue praising our resurrected Lord for all eternity. And we can begin in those praises today, in our living, in our celebration, in our life. We're called into true relationship, to recognize that in resurrection, the Spirit of Christ is making each one of us new, the people we sit beside, the people we work beside, the people we live beside. They are being made new in the image and likeness of our resurrected Lord. We're called into true stewardship of creation to recognize that God is at work making the world new. That we are charged as humanity to live with the understanding that there is permanence, to the actions that we make, and this includes the world. The goal, the tasks of humanity do not change, just even more so because of the resurrection. Made a reference to the tree of life. And in the post-resurrection story, it's the body and the blood of Jesus that is the sustenance, the tree of life, the one that is the source to able to restore us, to encourage us, to nourish us, to continue the process of making us all new. And we're able to reach out, to partake, to touch the symbol of our resurrected Lord, to proclaim his death until he comes, to proclaim that he has defeated death until he comes. We're able to take and eat of his body and blood with slight intentional allusions to John 6. We're able to feast on him so that we may have life. In all this, we're called in this double call of the communion table to recognize that this is the place where our renewal begins, but also the place where we're called to participate in his action of renewal, in his action of gardener over new creation. We're invited to come, to reach out, and to touch at the table for nourishment, for strength, for new life. Our bread is gluten-free and lactose-free, even if it's somewhat collapsed in and of itself today. We have hand sanitizer both at the back and at the front for you to use. We also have response cards and prayer cards if you feel like you'd like to write out prayers, prayers to God for encouragement, for strength, for those in need around you. If you'd like somebody to pray with, Garth would be happy to pray with you. I would invite you, as each week, to respond as the Lord is leading you. If you need to sit quietly, if you need to move about, we invite you to do so. The worship team will come forward and then lead us in songs that draw us further into response as we contemplate Jesus as gardener and Jesus as the first actor in this great thing of new creation.